Well, Persia, as we have seen, was at the time of the writing of this book of Esther, around about 480 BC. Persia was the great world superpower. It dominated a vast area around the eastern Mediterranean and right across 127 different provinces, different regions, different nations, really. And the king Ahasuerus was lord over all this great, this vast empire. He was a proud king. He was a mighty king. But he was also a fairly rash king who seemed to think that he could do whatever he liked and everything would turn out for his good. We observed in our first study in this book that he wasn't the only proud person living in Persia at the time. And his own queen, Vashti, had her own standards of what she was willing to do. And she wouldn't be humiliated even for her husband before a drunken mob of men in a king's party. We observed how drunken Ahasuerus could become a madman, willing to be persuaded by his advisors to do strange things that didn't add up to sober judgment. We observed how he got rid of his queen, how he went into battle against the Greeks, who at the time and for the next 150 years would battle with Persia for supremacy of the world. Ahasuerus lost his skirmishes in Greece. But he returned to his citadel in Susa, in Shushan. And there, as he pondered the things that had happened to him, he remembered what he had done to the most beautiful woman in Persia, who had been his wife and now had been banished. And as much as he regretted losing his battles against Greece, he regretted some of the things that he had done within the walls of his own palace. And in a strange way, rather than looking for a new wife among the noblemen of Persia, seeking a daughter of aristocracy with royal blood flowing through her veins, Ahasuerus again took the advice of those around him and chose his queen from a beauty parade. This was Miss Persia to 480 BC. But Miss Persia happened to be a Jew, though King Ahasuerus didn't know it. And Miss Persia, like Queen Vashti before her, had a mind of her own. She had her own standards. She wasn't all beauty and no brain, as perhaps the advisers had hoped. And so we come to this interesting part in the history of Persia and the history of the Jewish nation. Haman, the king's right-hand man, has been given absolute power in the land. The king has actually handed over to him his signet ring, by which any law can be made and sealed in the name of the king and could then never be revoked. He must have had incredible trust in Haman. And Haman used it to his own advantage. He plotted against the whole Jewish nation because one man, Mordecai, a Jew, had refused to bow down before him. Now, as we saw last week, that wasn't simply a matter of pride on Mordecai's part. It wasn't simply that he was unwilling to bow down to anyone else. It was a matter of protocol to bow the head to bend the knee before someone who was in a position of authority in the Empire of Persia. Mordecai sat in the king's gates. He was a judge. He was an advisor to the people who would come. He was well respected. We cannot believe that he would have got this far in his life as a respected man if he had been unwilling to bend to protocol. No, he was used to bowing. But this went further, as we saw. A decree had been passed that people should bow before Haman and pay homage to him. This was almost an act of worship. And as we saw last week, Mordecai was unwilling to worship any man, least of all Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the sworn enemies of the Jews. A nation that should have been stamped out some 500 or so years earlier when Saul was king in Jerusalem. This Agag, king of the Agagites, should have been executed, but he was saved by Saul, who had mercy upon someone that God had told him he should not have mercy upon. Mordecai is not willing to go down the same road as Saul. He remembers the lessons that Saul learned so bitterly, that he who rejects the will of God, God will reject him. Saul had been rejected as king. David had been set up in his place. And now Mordecai, who stands before Haman, is unwilling to break the law of God, to compromise even in this small way. And because of it, the whole of the Jewish nation living in Persia is brought under condemnation. On one day, in about 11 months' time, anyone who was known to be a Jew could be legally executed. Not only could be legally executed, must be executed. Letters are sent out by couriers into all the king's provinces. Couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan the citadel. And the city was confused. The city was perplexed. But the king and Haman, they sit down to drink. The king in ignorance, Haman with a little smile on his face. And so we reach chapter 4. When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes, he put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. He couldn't sit where he normally sat, inside the king's gate, at the place of judgment and advice. But everyone who went in and out, all the courtiers of the king who would walk in and out of that gate, in and out of the palace, they saw Mordecai there. All the people who went for advice, who sought judgment, who wanted a vow witnessed by the leaders of the city, they saw Mordecai sitting there in sackcloth and ashes, crying with a bitter cry. And the maids of Esther and the eunuchs who cared for her, they came and told the queen, "Do you know Mordecai? He's sitting at the king's gate in sackcloth and ashes." And we've observed how attached Mordecai and Esther are, how day after day after day Mordecai would go to the palace to see how Esther fared. And we can assume that this has continued as he sat in the king's gate each day, listening to people making their vows and passing judgment and so on, that the eunuchs, the maids of Esther, would have brought news of Esther and carried news from him to Esther. And Esther then is there in the king's palace, and she hears this news: Mordecai in sackcloth and ashes. This cannot be. And so Esther calls Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs whom he had appointed to attend her, and gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. Esther knows nothing. Things are so sheltered inside the king's palace that Esther the queen has not the slightest inkling of what confusion and perplexity there is, not only in Shushan, but throughout the empire. In every province, wherever the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. The whole nation is in turmoil. Not only the Jews, we're given this hint at the end of chapter 3, the whole city of Shushan is perplexed. Non-Jew as well as Jew. What on earth is going on? Why are these Jews suddenly being picked on in this incredible way without any reason being given for why they should be exterminated? And Esther doesn't know. She has no idea. And so Mordecai tells Hathach, tells him all that has happened. He's heard of the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay the king. He tells Hathach that. He gives him a copy of the decree that's been written for the destruction of the Jews. He asks him to explain it to Esther so that she can be absolutely certain of all its implications, exactly what it means. There's a crisis in Persia. And what's going to happen? The decree has gone out. It is in the tradition of the law of the Medes and the Persians that this decree cannot be revoked. Mordecai encourages Esther to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. But he, in doing so, he knows that the law can't be revoked. It can't be annulled. The king can't change his mind now. This is the nature of these laws, and it shows just how foolhardy the king was to have entrusted Haman with the king's seal. Allowed him to do whatever he liked. Didn't say, well, you draft something and let me have a look at it. Esther knows nothing about this, and we have the impression that even the king himself is not aware of exactly what is going on. He has been led to assume that there's this little group of people somewhere in the nation who are not obeying his laws, and that they're causing unrest, and it's not going to bode well for the Persian Empire if they have this enclave within it of dissatisfied people who are renegades, outlaws. And so the king is led to believe that this group needs to be stamped out. Doesn't realize that it's a people who are spread throughout the whole land. It's a people who are actually law-abiding citizens, and it's only on this one issue that one man has refused to bow the knee to Haman and to pay him homage. We do not know the what ifs. What if the king had known about this? What would he have done? Would he have allowed Haman to have gotten away with this awful decree? Nevertheless, here is the situation. The nation is in crisis. the people will perish. That is the understanding of the text, is it not? Mordecai told him all that had happened to him. The sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. This is his aim. He's had a decree. It's gone out throughout the land. The Jews must perish. It's a nation in crisis. But the story goes on. Mordecai believes that Esther should go into the king. But Esther reminds Mordecai of the situation. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the court of the king who has not been called has but one law, may be made on another rash occasion. He must be put to death unless the king extends the scepter and allows that person to live. And she goes on to say, and yet I myself have not been called to go in to the king these 30 days. It's difficult really to know how to understand that, because one would have thought if 30 days have passed, then it's possible that any day now she's going to be called. It's been such a big gap. Or it may imply that she's perhaps not really in favour anymore. That the king's moods have changed and he's not interested in her, and it may be a long time before she's called again. That's certainly the tone of it, isn't it? Esther saying, I haven't been called. I haven't been called for 30 days. I've got no expectation of being called again anytime soon. She knows the law. She remembers Vashti. And Mordecai has some stern words to say to Esther, his cousin. Don't think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. If you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have come to this kingdom for such a time as this? The nation is in crisis. The Jews will perish, according to the decree. And yet, Mordecai speaks with such incredible confidence. Don't think that you're going to survive, he says to Esther. Don't think that you're going to survive because you're in the king's palace, because you're protected in this way, because the king seems to be pleased with you and will do almost anything for you. Don't think that you're going to save your own skin. If you don't do something now, if you don't try and save your people, God will save them anyway. But you will be rewarded for your unwillingness to play a part. That's the essence of what Mordecai is saying here. God will deliver the Jews. He has this absolute certainty. God has promised that the Amalekites will be blotted out, that the Agagites will be completely wiped out from the face of the earth. However much Haman may seem to be in the ascendancy, even though he seems to have everything on his side, including the law of the Medes and the Persians, Mordecai has complete confidence in God. Deliverance will arise for the Jews. God has promised that a king will sit upon the throne of David forever. Haman will not get away with this. God promises to say. But God's working is always through means. He uses people. And in this situation, we find the same thing. Mordecai believes with all his heart that the Jews will be delivered. But he also believes with all his heart that Esther is in the king's palace at this time for this reason, that she can save the Jews. God will deliver the Jews. And Mordecai believes that it is through Esther that he will deliver them. God promises to save his people. And the means of his salvation through the likes of Abraham, of Moses, of David, of Daniel, of Esther. And so we see Esther's change of mind. Go, she says, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. We've seen the crisis. It's of incredible proportions. We've seen the confidence of Mordecai that God will deliver. And now observe the courage of Esther. I will go. I know the king's law is against me. I know his favour even might be against me since he has not called me these 30 days. But I will go. I'll walk into the king's court. And I will see whether he raises his sceptre to me or not. She listens to Mordecai and she sees the need. The Jews are under a death sentence. She sees the need for herself to take a stand. She can't sit on the fence, pretend that she's not a Jew, hope that her relationship with the king will save her skin. She knows that she must act. She listens to Mordecai, and what Mordecai says makes complete sense. She has to do what Mordecai did. A day, 2 days, a few days earlier. She has to make a stand on God's side. What will it do? What will it bring for her? Mordecai's stand in obedience to God brought a death sentence upon the Jewish nation in Persia. Will Esther's stand bring life out of death? We've seen the courage and the willingness to go that other men and women in the scriptures had. You think of Moses, grown up in the palace of Pharaoh, the superpower a few centuries before Persia. Himself, probably under sentence of death, having killed an Egyptian, flees, and for 40 years he lives in safety and peace as a shepherd in Midian. And then God comes to him and says, I want you to go back to Egypt, back to those people, and I want to use you to deliver them. And Moses, somewhat reluctantly, but nevertheless, in the end, willingly went. I will go, he said. Think of Joshua. There in the promised land, spying it out, seeing the great fortresses that the people had built, seeing the giants that lived there, seeing the immense power and wealth of the nations that lived in the promised land. But he came back, and contrary to 10 out of the 12 spies, he said, "We must go." And in the providence of God, he did go, and he led Israel into the land that God had promised them. Of course, these words of Esther's reflect more of Isaiah's words than anyone else's, don't they? When God asks the question, "Who will go for us?" After Isaiah has seen the glory of God, he says, "I will go." And then there's the Apostle Paul. And he, who had been a great persecutor of the church, confronted by Jesus on the road to Damascus, was willing to go for God. And Ananias, wondering whether God had made a mistake, said, "This is the persecutor of the church." And God says, "Yes, I know, and I will show him what great things he will suffer for my sake." And Paul suffered time and time and time and time again, but he was always willing to go. The world is in crisis. It's on the road to destruction, just as the Jews in Persia. And who will save it? Those who trust in God know that he is a faithful deliverer. Deliverance will come. And deliverance has come in Jesus Christ, who said, "I will go. I will go into that world. I'll take on human likeness. I will stand in the place of those people. I will be their representative. I will obey your law in their place. And I will stand in judgment before you and take on myself their sins. And I will bear their punishment. I will go and I will deliver." And these things that are happening in Esther aren't just a story, as we've seen. They're ensuring that what would happen 500 years later would indeed happen. That Jesus would come. That there would be a Jerusalem to come to. And a people to save. God is at work in all of this, and we can have the same confidence that Mordecai had. God will deliver. We will not perish when God is ready to preserve us. Jesus Christ has come to deliver, to preserve. But if we're followers of the Lord Jesus Christ, we stand in a similar place to Esther. Jesus said to his disciples in Luke's Gospel, chapter 9 and verse 23, "If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and daily follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it." That's what Mordecai said to Esther, isn't it? You desire to save your life? Keep silent? Pretend you're not a Jew? You're going to lose it. "But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and is himself destroyed or lost?" He who loses his life, lays it down in God's service, will not perish, but will be preserved. And the question really for us is, will we make a stand like Mordecai? will me make a stand like Esther, knowing the dangers, being filled with fear as undoubtedly Esther was, but nevertheless willing to say, Lord God, I will go for you. I will stand up and be your witness, even though men may be against me, even though they may do all kinds of things to make my life difficult, painful, even unbearable, I will go. Isn't that what John chapter 3 is talking about? By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us. This is the great thing. Christ died for us while we were yet sinners. He loved us before we loved him. And we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. And then John goes on to say, whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? That was Esther's situation. She was in the king's palace. She had influence. It weren't material things that she had, perhaps, in this situation to help, but she had position. And Mordecai was arguing, use it! Or for sure, you'll lose it. And the same message comes to us. Whatever situation we may be in, God has given us certain gifts, material possessions, possibly, but more likely he's given us opportunities that we can use to be his witnesses, to serve others, to bring others to the Lord Jesus Christ, that they may bow the knee to him and be saved from perishing. Will you go? Is the question. Mordecai asked Esther, will you go? Will you go?